Good day. Welcome to the Guardians of the Holy Grail with Mark Amaru Pinkham. This program will explore the secrets behind the Knights Templar and other secret mysteries of the world today. Now here's your host, Mark Amaru Pinkham.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Guardians of the Holy Grail, the program dedicated to diving deep to uncover and expose the truth behind the Knights Templar, the secret societies, and the ancient Holy Grail mysteries. The Guardians of the Holy Grail show was created by me in order to clear up many of the popular misconceptions that have been advertised in the popular media over the last few years regarding the secret societies and the Holy Grail mysteries and the bloodline from Jesus and Mary Magdalene. Through this show, I hope to set the record straight with hard facts from authors and researchers, as well as with testimonials from current and past members of the Knights Templar, Freemasonry, and other initiatic societies. I myself am a Knight Templar of the International Order of Gnostic Templars, which was founded to revive the mystical rites and wisdom of the original Knights Templar, which over the centuries has either been lost or ignored. Now you can learn more about our Gnostic Templar organization and sign our mailing list if you'd like and receive our monthly e-news by visiting our website, which is www.gnostictemplars.org. And there's tons of information there about what we are all about, what we're doing, and what we can give you if you decide to become either an associate member or an initiated member of our organization. Now, today, if you'd like to call in with a question, feel free to do that, and you can use our toll-free line, and the number for that is 866-472-5795. Now, before I start today's show, I'd like to give you a couple of updates. Many of you know that I've been involved in co-sponsoring, co-organizing a conference, a special conference in Italy that will take place in April. The exact day is April 17th, and it'll be in a town called Macerata, Italy, which is about 3 hours northeast from Rome. And this is a congress or a conference where many members of various initiatic societies will be coming together. Actually, the name that we've recently firmed up, that is the official name of the conference, is the International Conference about the Mission of the Initiatic Societies, which I think is very good because it kind of tells you exactly what it's all about. We are coming together, all us members of Initiatic Societies, to talk about our common origins, why we were initially formed, and if we have been able to succeed in manifesting our original goals for being created. Okay, our contention is that we'll be spoken about during the conference is that we were all part of the underground stream of the Gnostic and alchemical path, that we were formed in order to preserve those mysteries. Right? But we were also formed in order that eventually we would be able to share those mysteries when it was safe enough to do that. We would be able to share those mysteries not only amongst ourselves, but amongst everybody in the world. And now is the time for that to happen. So one thing we're going to do is create a major alliance of all initiatic societies called the World Alliance for Planetary Enlightenment. And through that alliance, we're going to work on trading information back and forth, getting straight about what we are all about, what our original intention was for becoming these initiatic societies, and also how we can spread this our secret Gnostic or previously secret Gnostic and alchemical wisdom throughout the planet when it's really needed. Now, everybody's invited to this this conference, and it's free. So all you have to do is pay to get your way over there, and put yourself up for a few days in a hotel. And actually, there is one hotel there that most of us are using, and we're getting a special discount on it. So if this is something you're really interested in, you'd like to participate, you'd like to be part of what we think is going to be a pretty historic event, you can contact me at GnosticTemplars@AOL.com, which is my personal email address, or you can also visit our website where we're currently updating our page that advertises this conference. And our website address is www.GnosticTemplars.org. So I hope that a lot of you can come. One new development around the conference is we're thinking about having a webcam going throughout the conference that will be broadcasting to some page on the internet. Probably it'll be a page on our website. But if that firms up and it becomes a reality, we'll definitely let you know. We would like as many people to be able to participate in this conference and you know, see what's going on, whether they're in Italy or not. Another special event I'd like to mention that's coming up this year. This will be an event in September, and it's a special pilgrimage that I'll be leading or co-leading with my friend Nancy Safford into the Languedoc, Rennes-le-Château region, as well as other places in southern France and northern Spain. We plan to visit Rennes-le-Château, the whole entire area there, as well as Montsegur, the famous church or headquarters or bastion, shall we say, of the Cathars. Also, Saint Marie de la Mer, which is a town on the Mediterranean that supposedly Mary Magdalene landed when she came to France. Also Montserrat, which has many, many mysteries and many secrets regarding the Holy Grail. The Templars were there. There's a Black Madonna there. There was supposedly Holy Grail initiations that occurred in these jagged rocks that Montserrat is named after. It's an amazing place. Throughout this pilgrimage, there's going to be a lot of meditations and rituals. We're going to have one on the full moon, on the fall equinox, and there'll even be an opportunity to get initiation into the path of the Gnostic spiritual warrior. So I think it's going to be a very exciting time. Recently, we had a commitment, we were given a commitment by the famous author Henry Lincoln to be a speaker on the tour, and we're also trying to get Ben Hammett, those of you that have been studying the film Bloodline and some of the recent discoveries in Rennes-le-Château, know that there was a cave that was found there that holds a mummy. There's a mummy there that they think might be the mummy of Mary Magdalene. And this was a cave found by Ben Hammett, and he was on my show recently. And if you didn't hear that show, you can archive it if you go to bbsradio.com. It was a really amazing show to find out about his discoveries and what led him to his discoveries. But anyway, it's going to be a fabulous tour or pilgrimage. And if you go to www.sacredsitesjourneys.com, you can learn all the details around this pilgrimage. You can sign up. You can register for it. And if you register before March 15th, you'll actually get a special discount. So you don't want to wait. Okay, so today we're going to be talking more about the Rennes-le-Château mysteries and the Holy Bloodline mysteries. Our guest is Paul Caron, who's an investigative researcher who believes he's been able to crack the code of some of the so-called Priory of Sion documents that were supposedly found by Baron J. Saunier, and have baffled researchers for many years. For those of you who have studied the Bloodline Mysteries, you'll be familiar with two of the documents we're going to be discussing today, which is the Dagobert document and Le Serpent Rouge. Our guest, Paul Caron, is a part-time investigative researcher and a senior maintenance controller for one of the largest flight schools in the United States. He was first introduced to the Rennes-le-Château mysteries in 1996 through the book The Tomb of God. After that time, he began to study all facets of the mysteries, and especially the encoded documents that were supposedly discovered by the priest Baron J. Saunier and believed to contain information regarding the bloodline between Jesus and Mary Magdalene. After about a year of trying many approaches to crack the code that these documents were written in, Paul finally understood that the cipher used in these documents was primarily mathematical in nature. It then took about 2 years to work out certain connections in the documents, such as their link that unites them to the Church of Saint-Sulpice in Paris. Paul has since traveled to both Rennes-le-Château and Saint-Sulpice in Paris to confirm certain details of the documents, and apparently he plans to return very soon in April to follow up with some new leads. So greetings, Paul. Welcome to the Guardians of the Holy Grail.
Mark, I'm happy to join you.
Well, Paul, there's been a lot of talk about the Rennes-le-Château documents as being forgeries. But I have to say, since having Ben Hammett on the show and seeing where the clues left by Saunier has led Ben to some 2,000-year-old artifacts and this cave that contains this intriguing mummy, I'm much more inclined now to believe that the documents may be true. What's your opinion on this?
Well, in all of my research, I've not uncovered any new evidence that the documents predate the 1960s. That is apart from the information that they actually contain. That information is authentic, arcane, and has been occluded from public view for, well, almost 400 years now. In the end, it really doesn't matter to me if they are the documents found by Baron J. Saunier or not. It's the information that's within them that's important to me. And I believe that there is some strong evidence that they were actually created in the 1960s, but that's not to say that they don't reveal something more important.
So they may have been created recently, however, the information they contain, you believe, is authentic and possibly very ancient.
Yes, I do, most definitely.
Well, how would you rate the influence that the book Tomb of God had on you being able to break the code? I understand that one of the authors of the book was himself an engineer and very good with numbers himself, and approached the Rennes-le-Château mysteries from a very left-brain perspective like yourself. So how would you rate the influence that book has had on your research?
Well, it was the book that introduced me to the topic, and to be candid, when I first read it, I really didn't know what to make of the central thesis of Andrews and Schellenberger, but I assumed that it had very little to do with the alleged mystery of Mary Magdalene or tomb or even the body of Christ, and I shelved the book mostly unread. And it wasn't until a couple of years later that I pulled it down and started delving into it. I'll say about the Tomb of God that of all the researchers out there, Andrews and Schellenberger got the farthest into the puzzle. They discerned one core element of the structure. It does have a geometric component, as many have speculated, but it's much more complex than merely geometry. But then they break down, and they head down a different path with their canted square and such. And one of the most crucial mistakes that they made is the original documents that were published by Gerard de Sede in Le Hors de Rennes contained various ticks and dots scattered throughout them. And the Andrews and Schellenberger instruct their readers in the Tomb of God to ignore them, saying that they're meaningless. And sadly, those are absolutely essential to understanding how the document works. There are many versions of the documents out there, and if they don't have the ticks or are not properly scaled, there's very little chance that somebody would be able to decode them. The book itself did provide the essential clue that broke the basic structure. It was unintentional, certainly on Andrews and Schellenberger's part, and it's a reference to a alchemical device known as the trigonocentric centrum, and it was said to. It's often referred to as Barringer Saunier's book plate, which is erroneous. It dates back to the early 1600s, the earliest reference I've found is the 1625 alchemical treatise, The Golden Age Restored, by Heinrich Mantithanus, and later reproduced in Grassoff's 1625 Dies Chemica Tripartita. If there's a simple way of summarizing what is within the Dagobert document, it is the trigonocentric centrum. It is this arcane mathematical device which simultaneously describes a number of elements to the mystery. It reveals the partial significance of January 17, technical details about the Observatory of Saint-Sulpice in Paris, the chancel design of the church, and cartography, as many have suspected.
Well, before we get into those documents, would you say then that the cipher that you discovered is a cipher that was used in all the different documents? So if you can discover the cipher, you can decode them all.
No. There's multiple layers of ciphering. A simple example would be the simple raised letter cipher that Henry Lincoln found many years ago. Very simple. It's obviously a lead-in to grab the reader's attention and explore a little more deeply. The Shepherdess text is an enormously complex, very convoluted cipher, double transposition cipher using two chessboards and a keyword. So already we have two different enciphering systems, one for each document. And there is another layer within the Dagobert document and another layer within the Shepherdess text. And it's here that I have to say that there are additional information in the Shepherdess text that I have not been able to resolve. Most of my expertise right now is with the Dagobert document.
Well, when was your initial aha, when you finally were able to crack at least one of the codes, and how did you know that you had actually been able to do it?
Well, it's a very interesting question. The fascinating thing to me is how intertwined and complex this story is and how sophisticated the documents actually are. The Shepherdess text, the decipherment that was leaked in the late 1960s, the famous Shepherdess No Temptation that Poussin tenures hold the key phrase, actually contains some of the references that let you know when you've arrived at the right solution. And the most important of those clues, at least in my estimation, is the digit sequence 681 and the term midday, which refers to meridians. The device that's hidden within the Dagobert document is a device not described in any modern mathematical literature. It's a variation of what's called Raphael's theorem, a very obscure geometric theorem, famously depicted at the apostolic apartments in Rome by Raphael Sanzio in his painting School of Athens. It's a variation on that, but what's most important about it is that the device intrinsically holds the digit sequence 681. It appears in internal ratios, in angular references, in trigonometric functions, in Pythagorean triples, and right triangles, and it's absolutely fascinating to me. The more I learn about it, the more fascinating it becomes. It's almost jewel-like in its complexity, and it never ceases to amaze me, the type of information that you can extract from it. So the most important clue was the discovery that the device, because when I discovered the initial device, I had no direct confirmation that it was correct. It could have been as subjective as any of the other theories that were put out in the past. But when I discovered that this digit sequence shows up over and over again in the mathematical structure, it was very direct confirmation that we were, or I was on the right track. There are other elements of the Dagobert text that are explained by the device. And most importantly, there's a small geometric figure up in the upper left-hand corner, which is really the key to arriving at the final structure. It's very veiled cryptic hint at certain relationships between internal angles. And then there's a small M above the device, above a raised bar, and many have speculated that it might signify a meridian or perhaps Mary or some other element. As it turns out, it's very simple. You rotate it on its side, and it's minus 30 degrees, and minus 3 degrees plays a role in the relationship of the chancel of Saint-Sulpice and its angular rotation in relationship to the solar observatory. And it's just breathtaking in its complexity, but it's easily demonstrated visually. It's very difficult to explain in a context like our conversation now. And there's certainly many details that I'm not ready to reveal yet. I am currently writing and trying to finish up some research before I go to publication.
Well, can you say in a general way, in layman's terms, what exactly the Dagobert document is meant to, what information is it meant to give?
It reveals several things simultaneously, and if you turn your attention to Le Serpent Rouge, Le Serpent Rouge is really a guidebook. It contains elements that help you solve the puzzle, and very explicitly it tells you that it has a cartographic solution. And the church itself, you know, Saint-Sulpice was let me back up just a bit and put this in context. The device itself, I believe, was discovered somewhere around 1604. Trigonometry had developed to a point where it's plausible that the internal angles could have been arrived at, and thus the connection to the digit sequence 681. And to somebody, it had perhaps even magical properties. When we think of the late Renaissance mind and their interest in math and Platonic solids and geometry, but its significance, its is probably cartographic. At least that's what Le Serpent Rouge implies. And you mentioned Ben Hammett in your introduction. I'll be seeing Ben here in a few weeks, and we're going to be following up on some of his leads and some of mine as well. But I think ultimately the intent was to lead the investigator to a specific location.
Okay, so it's another treasure map then?
Possibly. I really don't know what is there. There's been a lot of speculation, and hundreds of books written on the topic. The interesting new development is we now know the exact center of the map, and we know its exact scale. But the problem is we don't know where on the map we're supposed to look now. We have our frame of reference, and I've been spending considerable number of hours trying to resolve that before the upcoming trip in April, but I'm not really holding out much hope I'll be able to get it solved by then. And it's here that I can say exactly what is at the center of this map, and it's Le Rope Negre, to people who know the area. And if there are people amongst your listeners who have pretty inside knowledge to the significance of the 681 armature and its importance, they will recognize that I'm telling the truth. They will know that, well, somebody has discovered that it is Rope Negre, and thereby I can authenticate myself to them, because one of the goals in granting interviews, I'm an enormously private person and usually reluctant to do this sort of thing, but it's to see if there are true initiates out there who understand the meaning and significance of this, and if they're willing to enter into dialogue and discuss its aspects.
Well, have you discovered clues in these documents that tell you where this, what's at the end of this treasure map, where what it leads to?
You can only turn to Le Serpent Rouge, and whether Le Serpent Rouge is telling the truth about what's there or not is not really relevant. I shouldn't put it quite that way. It's what we are meant to believe, what we are led to believe, is explicitly stated in Le Serpent Rouge. It says we are looking for the tomb of Mary Magdalene. Now, do I believe that? I'm not certain. I suppose it's within the realm of possibility. I do believe strongly that there is something to be found. It may be an empty hole in the ground. It may be an empty necropolis, or it could be something as spectacular as a tomb. I can say with certainty that it is not the same tomb that my friend Ben Hammett found, if it is indeed a tomb.
Okay, so the indications on the documents from how you've decoded them would not lead you to the cave that Ben found?
No, it would not. Now, we believe, and there's some things that I at this point I can't say because they're part of Ben's private research, and so where this information came from, we have reason to believe that there are three locations in the area. I believe strongly that the first location was the one that Ben discovered. And the other two, we don't know if they're intact or if they're tombs or just what they are. One speculation that we've entertained is that when Sancel Peace was built, that whatever was originally hidden in the Languedoc was moved there for that purpose to the new Temple of Solomon. Now, that's just speculation on my part. I have no evidence of that. But I will say about speculation, the whole process of deciphering the documents is a heuristic problem-solving approach. You have to examine all the possibilities and filter through them, and even filter through your own expectations or beliefs about what might be there. For example, people for many years have almost held it as doctrine that the documents hold a pentagonal geometry, and it's not true. if there's any number that's inherent to the document, it's not phi, the irrational number phi, but the square root of 3, it has a hexagonal core. So when you're approaching these things, you have to investigate all the possibilities, the possibility that what we're looking for was moved, or that they may be telling the truth, that there may be a grave waiting to be found. And I really don't know, and I hope someday it is found. And I'd be delighted if it was myself and my friends that did so. But who knows? This mystery's been hanging out for at least 40 years of the document's existence, and if you accept the premise that this is an older mystery, then 380 years.
Well, Paul, you referred to St. Sulpice as being the new Temple of Solomon. Well, I'm sure you're aware that that's what Ben is hot on the trail of apparently right now, trying to find some underground Temple of Solomon in the Rennes-le-Château area. Could St. Sulpice be the Temple of Solomon that he's looking for?
It could be. It could be. I do have to agree with my friend Ben that there is something yet to be found down there. Ben has one additional document that he has not published in his book that contains certain cartographic clues. They differ somewhat from what I found. The general area appears to be separated by about a kilometer. But again, we do believe there's three sites, so it could be that they're all simultaneously correct. We just don't know that yet.
I don't remember asking Ben at the time when I interviewed him, but if very extensive or has any ground scans been performed in these areas where it's believed that the underground Temple of Solomon might be?
I know that Bill Kersey, who's another friend of mine and who I hope to see next month, has done some GPR work up around Rennes-le-Château. As far as Ben's site, I don't believe so, given the nature of the it's in a cave. There's only a very narrow shaft that leads down to it, a couple meters long, and no terminal access. And I don't know much about GPR, but my suspicion is that the site is not conducive to using GPR because it's solid rock. And my understanding of ground-penetrating radar is it's looking for soil disturbances. I don't know when the tomb that Ben's found will be excavated. I'm hoping sometime soon. But as far as I know, there have been a few circumstances where GPR was used, but I think it was mostly around the village of Rennes-le-Château itself, not in the environs of Rennes-le-Bain or Pecardu or any of those areas that people have speculated that these sites might be at.
Well, when you're in Rennes-le-Château in April and you get connected with Ben, are you going to then become part of his party out searching for the Temple of Solomon, or are you going to kind of go in your own direction?
We tend to hang out. This will be my third joint trip with Ben and Sandy Hamblett. Our mutual friend Renee Barnett will be there as well, and others. We tend to divvy up a little bit. What we do is we like to hang out together, bounce ideas off one another. Ben will have a list of things that he wants to do, and I'll tag along, and we'll jump down caves or, search a site or visit a church, and then we'll go look at things that I'm interested in seeing. And this last trip, I had my wife with me, and I was pretty concerned that she'd have a good time. She's not a Wren enthusiast, so I spent probably more time focused on her than on the investigation, which was fine. Love her to death, and I sincerely wanted her to have a good time. I was afraid that with all the Wren geeks that she'd feel a little lost and perhaps even alienated, but she got on spectacularly with everybody.
Well, in previous visits to Rennes-le-Château, were you able, working alongside Ben, to uncover anything significant, any artifacts or anything?
No. Most of that work that had been documented in the Bloodline film was done by the first time I met Ben. I first met Ben at the European premiere of the film Bloodline. I'd been speaking with Renee Barnett and had met Renee and Bruce and a couple times visited with them. And she, unfortunately, was not able to go, and neither was Bruce. They were in the middle of filming a new documentary series for the Sci-Fi Channel and were called away, so they weren't able to travel over there. But I met Ben, Sandy Hamblett of the Rhodesian Journal, and Bill Kersey and others over there, some people that you might recognize from the Bloodline film. And most of the artifacts that he had found had been found by that point. So I had no direct involvement with any of that. We thought we were on to the path of a new bottle, surprisingly enough. Ben had captured a glint of glass in a remote camera that he had shoved down a cave at a nearby landmark. And we spent a couple days fishing down in there trying to see if we could retrieve it. And I think in the end we concluded it was a beer bottle. But that's about as close as we got.
Well, better luck.
Coming
to it. Excuse me.
Well, that's the thing about this. You can go for very long periods without discovering something. And, you know, where Ben really shines in all of this is he has produced artifacts. Now, there are questions of their provenance. I'm absolutely convinced of Ben's sincerity. I don't believe there's any deception on his part. There may be circumstances where, he may have been deceived by others, but I have no evidence of that either. The tomb is real. And Ben is a sincere, even humble guy, and I am absolutely convinced that what is there is authentic.
Well, I've always been very intrigued with Saint-Sulpice and have mm-hmm. myself visited there in the past. It has quite a interesting history, apparently. Has been the headquarters for a number of mystery secret societies over the years, and so it wouldn't surprise me that you might find some clues or some hidden treasure there. So you went there some years ago. What did you find?
Well, my intent there was to verify details of the solar observatory. There's a lot of mention of meridians in various files of the Dozier C. Cray and Le Serpent Rouge. The term midi, which is in the Shepherdist text, referred to meridians over and over and over again. And there's a drawing in Le Serpent Rouge which shows the meridian line, which many people now call the Rose Line, cutting diagonally through the nave of the church. And one of the discoveries that came out of the document was that the observatory, which was not put in until, I believe, seven decades after church construction began, was actually planned from the start. It appears to be an afterthought, but the rotational alignment of the church is exact. Its relationship to the floor design, designed by Christopher Gamar, who incidentally was a friend of Nicolas Poussin, the painter of Shepherds of Arcadia. When the meridian was put in, the solar observatory, the work was begun by a gentleman, an English clockmaker named Henri Sully, and he wasn't able to finish the work. And a astronomer, French astronomer, Le Monnier, finished the work. And one of the things I had found in the document was where the meridian was indicated to be did not appear to be where the actual meridian is now. I had roughly a 45 centimeter error offsetting it to one side. And so I was astonished to learn in J.L. Heilbron's book, The Sun and the Church, that the original line that was installed by or begun by Henri Sully was moved by Le Monnier 40 centimeters. So again, this was, for me, it was a very gratifying confirmation that the work, it wasn't a mistake. What the document was indicating was what was originally planned.
And so at this point, you're thinking that perhaps those documents that Sonnier was able to find and everyone else now is trying to find them, that maybe they were actually hidden in Saint-Sulpice. Is that right?
No, they contain information about Saint-Sulpice. It could be, as Gerard Desset said in his book, that they were copies of earlier documents, and that is within the realm of possibility. The problem is the documents have disappeared, and there's no way to determine their age or their provenance in any way. So the only thing that remains is the data that's within them. There's, as mentioned earlier, there's nothing that I've found that can offer evidence that the documents predate the 1960s.
But you think that maybe if you referred to Saint-Sulpice as the modern Solomon's Temple, so you believe that there is some kind of treasure, perhaps, that's hidden in Saint-Sulpice. Is that right?
It's possible. Yeah, it's possible. Working out the connections of why Sulpice was important to this mystery is enormously difficult. You're right in that it's been the home of various secret societies and has a air of mystery about it. What I suspect is that the device, the trigonocentric centrum, had important arcane significance. In other words, that significance was the cartographic aspect. It was that it revealed a place in Languedoc, and that it may be that Saint-Sulpice was secretly designed to memorialize those cartographic aspects or the trigonocentric centrum. It may be that something was moved there. It may be that something was on the original site that was moved from there to the Languedoc. It's really, really hard to say, and short of finding the something physical, whether there's a hole in the ground or a tomb or just what, will be really hard to connect those. So I'm taking the long way of saying that I have my speculations, but they're really just that at this point. They're speculations. What I can address is the things that are very tangible to me, and that's the mathematics that are in the core of the document and their relationship to the solar observatory, their relationship to the cartography around Rennes-Lavant, and where they appear to be leading. They've been trustworthy so far. The information that they've held has been reliable, and it could be that Le Serpent Rouge is really telling the truth, that there is something to be found in the environs of Rennes-Lavant.
Well, so what I understand from talking to you now is that basically the where people have been getting their clues previously were in the words of these documents, mm-hmm. but they really should have been looking deeper or looking at the mathematical associations to really be able to interpret them.
Yes, that's true. And it's entirely possible that there's another layer of encipherment. I've suspected for a long time that there is what is known as a geometric cipher hidden in one or both documents. And it's enormously difficult to work out if it indeed exists, what the algorithm was that was used to generate that message or what that message would contain. There are some possibilities. I do have extracted some short sentences from the structure, which unfortunately could be within the realm of just chance, accidental, or accident. They're not long enough yet. The character string is only 13 characters long, so there's plenty of opportunity for chance, for error. But I do suspect that there is a textual component to one or both documents, and I hope someday to fully unlock that.
Well, a lot of people think that some of the major clues, or maybe the most important clues, are in Nicolas Poussin's painting, The Shepherds of Arcadia. Have you been able to crack the code around that painting and come up with any clues?
Yes. That's a fascinating question. Originally, I turned, because there is a geometric component, and it had been hinted at that it may be incorporated in one or both versions of Shepherds of Arcadia, I spent a considerable amount of time investigating that. What I believe will require a little bit of background information. Nicolas Poussin spent most of his life in Rome, even though he was a French painter. And Louis XIII, through Cardinal Richelieu, recalled him to Paris area in the late 1630s. And he was assigned to work on certain design aspects of the Louvre with the architect Christopher Gamarre and Claude Perrault. Now, it's very evident that Christopher Gamarre knew the structure of the centrum because he used it in the design of the floor plan of the church. Because Paris in that time was a smaller intellectual milieu, and these gentlemen worked very closely with one another, including Claude Perrault, who was another architect in Saint-Sulpice, is very likely that Poussin was shown the basic floor plan of the chancel. And much like I believe that Saint-Sulpice memorializes something else, probably the cartography around Redmond-Bond, the painting Shepherds of Arcadia appears to be a memorial of the trigonocentric centrum again. It's very carefully hidden in the document. Once you see it, you can't say with certainty that it's the technique that the artist used, because compositional analysis is just fraught with epistemological danger. There are endless schemes where people have done painting analysis, and short of perhaps X-ray or study sketches by the artist, you can never really be certain what the particular method is. But the Dagobert document does contain hints on how the structure is to be aligned to the painting, Shepherds of Arcadia, and it does plausibly describe the painting composition. I've shared this with Dr. Adrian Lodge, who's done his own analysis of the work, and a local art history professor who really doesn't want to get involved in the Wren topic, because she is a tenured professor. She has described it as plausible and consistent with the painting. She thinks it is within the realm of probability that is the method that Poussin used. So the painting, Shepherds of Arcadia, holds that device. It's carefully hidden in the alignment of the shafts and the composition of the painting, the staffs, I should say, that the shepherds hold, the lines of the tomb, the position of the shepherdess, and interestingly, it depicts a tomb, which ties back nicely to Le Serpent Rouge. There's one thing that may be of interest that to you and your listeners. The phrase "et in Arcadia ego" is obviously incomplete, as many people have pointed out. But the sentence can be parsed in a couple of different ways, and it can be parsed to read, "Even in death, I am divine." and the divine in this case would be feminine, which would tie in nicely with, again, with Le Serpent Rouge, if that's indeed Poussin's intent. I don't know. There's also the quote by Nicolas Fouquet, who wrote to his brother about Nicolas Poussin, describing that Poussin was privy to some sort of great secret, very famously quoted. And I believe that Poussin was, in fact, connected with this mystery.
So could Poussin, through his painting, be revealing that there is an actual tomb to be found in the Languedoc region?
Yeah, I think that's possible, and maybe even probable given the information that's there. It could be that the painting was never intended to be decoded. It could be that it was just a secret homage to the mystery, known only to a very small social milieu, or maybe even just to the artist himself. But it begs the question, how did the creators of the parchments and Le Serpent Rouge make that connection? How did they make the connection between the device that's hidden within the painting and the church and the cartography and Poussin if it was not known to certain people? And in the end, that's what's compelling to me about this, is that the information revealed in the document has not been published, or at least in any place that I've been able to find, for 380 years. The technical details of the solar observatory were completely unknown until the documents were deciphered.
So I know a lot of people are simply trying to find a location in the Languedoc that meets or matches, you know, the painting.
Right.
I think it seems like, from what you're telling me now, they might be going about it all wrong.
Yeah, I think they are. This my opinion, obviously, but the tomb outside of Pontil, we really don't know how old it was. There's at least some evidence that it really didn't predate the 1900s, and Henry Lincoln and others had speculated that the tomb depicted in the painting was a Pontil tomb. But you can invert that question, and it becomes even somewhat interesting to ask the question, well, even if the tomb was built after the painting, was the tomb built to match the painting because somebody knew the significance of the painting itself? Again, an homage. They recognized perhaps the importance of the painting and decided to replicate it at the Pontil tomb. Only possibility, but could be.
Well, there's one thing that's always intrigued me a little bit. In one passage from one of the documents, apparently, the one that mentions Poussin, it says, "I achieved this demon of the guardian at noon, blue apples." And I've always wondered, you know, what does it mean by blue apples? As apparently has so many other people, considering him either, you know, every kind of theory has come up, like describing blue fruit or some connection to extraterrestrials. I mean,
yeah.
What's your make on this?
Well, it's here that I have to say that while I've been able to work out a good portion of the puzzle, there are elements that are still elusive. And the reference to pommes bleues or blue apples is one of those things that still stymies me. I was bouncing ideas off of Sandy and Hamlet and Ben last October when we were in Ren, and again we're really not making much ground on that clue either. I'll keep working at it, and we'll see if we can come up with it. But as of right now, I really do not know what Pomus Blues signifies.
Well, Well, when you go to Rennes-le-Château in April, are you going to have some information or some clues that can assist Ben in finding this underground Solomon's Temple?
I hope so. I have some candidate sites to investigate that are possibilities. There's no smoking gun yet, but they may be indicated. You know, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, we now know the exact center of the map. We know its exact scale, but we're not quite sure where to look on the map itself. But the document does have some oddities in that that may suggest that it's at the crossing of two important elements of the document. One I call the Ex Libris line, and the other one is the Meridian line itself. I have those coordinates and those locations loaded in my GPS and ready to go. And Ben and I, when we get there, we'll compare notes and we'll see where we end up.
Well, I'm sure everyone is cheering you on, let me tell you.
Well, I hope it's found someday, and I'd be delighted if it was myself that found it. But, you know, who knows? This mystery is aged for many decades, and it may linger on for many more. I don't know. Sometimes I feel like we're just extremely close, and then other times it feels very elusive. But I am very pleased with the amount of headway that the last 4 years have yielded. To me, there's absolutely no question about the structure and the map location itself, at least the center of the map and its scaling. These elements, you know, can be seen and verified through direct measurement, and you can see that they're razor sharp in their precision. But again, infuriatingly, it doesn't tell us where on the map we're looking yet. So hopefully we'll get lucky and we'll find it. But if it is a really important location, my fear is that it would be so well hidden that the entrance may be all but impossible to discover. But again, it raises the question, why then were these documents released to public awareness? It's my contention that whoever created them wanted them solved for whatever reason. And I really don't know what their goal was in the end by doing this. I am surprised, though, that it hasn't been discovered before. It has been 40 years, and a lot of people have looked at these documents, put a lot of time and creative energy into them. I'd say that my success with them comes down not so much to talent, but just bullheaded persistence and just coming back to it repeatedly, testing ideas over and over again until they yielded up some of their secrets. But no single element. Overall, the documents are enormously complex. But each step along the way could be understood by most people. There are some sophisticated aspects of spherical astronomy that may elude people, or perhaps some of the mathematics and stuff in the document. But in principle, any number of people could have discovered it. And it surprises me that it's taken this long. And I hope eventually to fully unlock the remaining meaning of the documents. I don't know how long that'll take. I'm hoping soon, but we'll see.
Well, Paul, you're currently in the process of writing a book, I understand. I assume it's related to cracking the code and your discoveries.
It is.
Rennes-le-Château. When is this book going to be available so we can read about it?
Well, I'm not real sure yet, and the problem with it, Mark, is I don't have an ending yet. And ideally, the ideal ending would be finding whatever is at the end of this trail. That would be my hope. But I do feel a moral obligation to publish and to put this information out in the public awareness, because if that information doesn't belong to me, ultimately, it belongs to all of us, as does whatever may be at that site. So I've been writing for a couple of years now, and it's mostly outlined. I really don't have a good estimate right now. When I started it, I thought I could finish it in a year. I would say right now a good estimate would be about 18 months before I could have a draft edited and reviewed. And also, I've been approaching certain academics, and this is proving to be enormously problematic. I get a lot of positive feedback, at least from some of them, but none of them are willing to go on the record and say, yep, I agree with this, and I'm going to put my professional reputation on the line to back it. I would ultimately like that endorsement from the academic community, but I'm beginning to feel doubtful that will happen, just because of the association with the Wren mystery, because so many, well, you know, frankly, silly things have been written about it. There have been a lot of very clever things, and very interesting research has been written, but there's also been a lot of nonsense, which has kind of muddied the waters and added maybe even a giggle factor to some of it. And so we'll see. Professor of art history that I'm in contact with right now, and we'll see. He's going to be reviewing the documents here in a couple weeks, at least the portions of them, and the presentations that I've got, and we'll see if he's willing to stick his neck out or not. But so, in answer to your question, I'm thinking 18 months to 2 years will probably be, and as that time approaches, I will likely put up a website and have an update on when it's going to come out, and perhaps even take pre-orders if there's enough interest, because it appears likely that I'll have to self-publish as well.
I know that Rene Barnett is organizing a conference in Washington, D.C. This July called EsoterraCon. Are you part of that conference?
She's invited me to attend. She hasn't asked me to speak, but I am going to attend. She wanted to get certain researchers together in kind of a private off-site conversation where we could bounce ideas off one another. I understand that she's trying to get Robert Howells to attend. I haven't met Robert. I'd be delighted to. I've got some ideas I want to bounce off of him. And others will be there. So I will be attending, likely, but I will not be speaking.
Well, I'm sure you'll make some great connections. It's she really seems to be putting the right people together in one room, so to speak.
I love Renee to death. She's a fabulous friend.
So I'm sure that something significant is going to come out of that. I just have a feeling. Anyway, when you get back from Wren Le Chateau, perhaps we'll have you on again, and especially if you found anything significant, any new clues or whatever.
I'd be delighted.
We'll update.
Yes. Anytime. Anytime.
Okay. Well, I'm, having had so many of you Wren Le Chateau people on the program, I feel like I'm one of you now. So I'm just as excited as the rest of you to find out
what's
happening.
You certainly know a lot of. Sorry to cut you off. I say you certainly know a lot of my friends. I was looking at your website last night. And
well, I guess we run in the same circles.
Yeah, Nancy Safford, Renee, Ben.
Yeah, right. Like I said, I feel like I'm one of you. So.
Yeah.
So good luck in April, and we'll be in touch. And And thank you so much for being on the show today and sharing your research.
Okay, you're welcome. It was a pleasure talking with you, Mark.
Okay, good luck, Paul.
Okay,
take care. Next week, we have a very exciting show with a very exciting guest, Margaret Starbird. I'm sure most of you recognize that name. She's been involved with the research around Mary Magdalene and the sacred bloodline with Jesus since the very beginning of that research started. The Woman with the Alabaster Jar, she's written a number of books, and well-researched woman, very knowledgeable, so you're not going to want to miss that. We're going to be talking about the life of Mary Magdalene and the revival of the divine feminine today. So, in the meantime, have a wonderful week, and as always, and I have to tell you this, and always remember that the Holy Grail exists right inside your own heart. So, bye for now.